I think Ray'll introduce me, and I'll come out and I'll do a bit of, you know, a few gags and stuff. And then I'll go, right, you have to be thick-skinned in business. It doesn't matter if you're the T-boy or the general manager. People will try and rock your confidence and shake your spirit. Do not listen to them, yeah? Let's try a little exercise. And I'll just go into the audience and I'll pick on someone at random. I'll just go, you, sir, what's your name? Say your name.
Leroy.
Where's Leroy come from?
The coloured fella off a thing.
What? Use your own name.
Oh, Gareth.
Hi, Gareth. Gareth, insult me, yeah? Let me show you that sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Just throw some insults at me and just, you know, and I'll show you how to roll with the punches.
Swindon lot don't seem to respect you.
Why would they say that? They don't know me. They're not going to know that. And it's not true. Do something else.
A lot of people are laughing at the heels on your shoes.
I'm not going to be wearing the shoes, am I?
You're going to be wearing the earring?
What, they're having a go at that as well, are they?
Some people are.
What else?
They've given you a nickname.
What, the Swindon lot?
Yeah, but everyone's using it.
What is it?
Well, I don't really
know. Come on, what is it?
Bluto.
The villain from Popeye?
Yeah.
Well, it's because of the beard.
That's because he's...
What's that? That's... I can't believe it.
Don't go on. They know it's me that told you. David!
Hello. Sorry, everybody. Look. We are one big happy family here, yeah? Now, I've been trying to welcome you new guys. You know, I didn't want you here, but you're here now. So, you know, well done. Welcome. But if there's one thing I don't like, it's nicknames, yeah? Because nicknames are bad names. Yeah? They're not helpful, yeah? They can be very hurtful to people. Not to me, it's like water for a duck's back. But, you know...
You used to call Malcolm Kojak.
That was affectionate, you know. He was a great detective and a fine actor.
Well, maybe Mr. Toad's affectionate.
Who's Mr. Toad?
Some people call you that as well.
I thought I was Bluto.
Yeah, Bluto and Mr. Toad.
Why am I Mr. Toad? There's the face again. What? It's an insult, isn't it? Very... body fascism. That's what that is. The toad is the ugliest of all the amphibians. I can't... If we're handing out insults for being fat, let's have a go at him. Look at him. Why... And he's got glasses. Let's call... Four eyes as well. Why don't we call him Fatty Fatty Toad Boy if we're... You know, at least start on him and then move on. Mr. Toad, I can't...
Pre-recorded live from Pennsylvania and Nebraska, US of A. It's the Bob and Elvis Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and Elvis Dingledean.
Good evening. Tonight, as of 1400 hours military time, I can report to America, the world, and the folks here at the Sizzler Steakhouse on Canyon Ranch Road, right outside of my gate-guarded community here in Dallas, Texas, where I also frequently eat lunch, that I have personally overseen a strategic and covert operation that killed the gopher who's been tearing up my backyard.
The following podcast contains harsh language, nudity, graphic violence, adult situations, and a healthy obsession with empirical reality. The Bob and Elvis Show.
That's right. Fatty, fatty toad boy.
The ugliest of all amphibians.
The ugliest of all the amphibians. Oh, God. Hey, it's the Bubble Genius Bob and Elvis Show. I'm Bob. That's Elvis. Today's show brought to you, as it always is, by www.bubblegenius.com. And it's bubblegenius.com.
The Hawaii edition of bubblegenius.com.
Yeah, that's right. We had lunch with Sarah and Paula from Bubble Genius. They flew out here. They've got a big birthday party on a big island, which is the much larger island down the chain with the volcanoes and all that crap. And
it's the name Big Island.
Big Island. And so they stopped off here just to have lunch with me and Joy. So we had we went down to Duke's Canoe Club. In Waikiki, and had
had our. Have you got key music for me today?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
I
didn't. Suck.
I don't have any. Do you have a gay story?
I'm sure I could come up with one.
I'm sure I can come up with some gay music. If you have a gay story, I can type up some a quick search term in YouTube, and I'm sure there'll be a gay.
Well, that's what you do when I'm talking normally, anyway. So.
That's right.
You're typing away at something.
Yeah. Like if you were to start telling a story now, it'd be appropriate because I'm actually already on YouTube looking up, you know, like a great, like a perfect song for your, you know, your gay ventures. Like
that. Yeah. Someone suggested it on Twitter. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is probably easily the gayest song in the world.
Yeah. And I've got a story already for this.
Hey, and you hit the post on that, too.
Ow!
Yep.
I told you I was so good at that. No, my fourth grade talent show.
Yeah.
Me and a bunch of friends, having no idea what the gay was, our contribution to the Frankfurt, Germany Elementary School talent show was a rousing rendition of YMCA.
Oh, my God.
All of us dressed in different... You know, costumes. I was the plumber.
You're the plumber. You're the plumber. The gayest of all amphibians.
The fourth grade equivalent of the gayest kid in the universe.
Now, wait, you know, there is no plumber. I'm looking at this video.
I know, that's why I don't get it. But I was a plumber.
You're the plumber.
I think there were too many of us, and we had to just make up other professions.
Other professions, right.
Maybe subconsciously I knew that there were very few gay plumbers, so that was a good choice for me. Plumbers. So, you know, I got up there, and we had duct taped a bunch of D-cell batteries together as the microphone handle, and then we had, like, crumpled up tinfoil as the microphone, you know, windscreen.
Yeah.
And, you know, just singing our hearts out to this song while my dad had a fucking heart attack in the audience.
Oh, God.
So incredibly gay. But it was the biggest song in the universe in 1970, whatever that was. So, yeah. You know, what are you going to do? You didn't know about gay when you're Frankfurt, Germany, grade school. But that was exceedingly, exceedingly gay.
I just caught a shot. I've never seen this music video before. I was checking it out on the YouTube. The biker, not so gay. No, I'm kidding. The biker is extraordinarily gay looking.
The Indian. So there's an Indian, a biker, a cop, right?
A construction worker.
Construction worker. Maybe that's what I was. Maybe that's what it was. I wasn't a plumber. I just remember I was in some, you know, day laborer outfit, you know, a t-shirt with like a pack of smokes rolled up in the I don't remember it, that ties as far as grade school gay goes. That episode ties with the time that we were all supposed to dress up for Halloween at school, but nobody did but me. And who I came as Schneider, the building guy from One Day at a Time.
Oh god,
I had this vest, you know, Schneider wore this really thin kind of suede, really hipster doofus vest, but the only vest I had was this, I can't even describe it, it's an abomination, but the inside of it was like fleece, and the outside was like lambskin. I mean, it was so dear, so delicate, so lovely. And so my mom penciled on like a cheesy patch, you know, Schneider from One Day at a Time mustache on, and rolled the fake pack of cigarettes up in my sleeve, which is so appropriate for sixth grade or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just did and I was literally the only one in my class that dressed up. It was like I showed up that way, like in, you know, March. There was no functional difference between that day and any other day, and there I am dressed like Schneider from a show that's basically for middle-aged women.
I'm transfixed by this video. Uh-huh. I'm marveling at how
gay it is.
Yeah, really. And you know what's especially gay is the fact that you remember the construction worker as being a plumber. That in and of itself is very gay.
Well, it's all plumbers to kids.
Well, okay.
Super. So we got that right out of the way.
Yeah. So that's it. The Elvis could be gay music. Out of the way, off the agenda. We can just strike that right off the agenda. So yeah, so had lunch with Bubble Genius at Duke's, and then we all had our picture taken in front of the Duke statue. Don't even ask me to pronounce the last name of Duke. He's
Come on, I want to lay you.
Yeah, he's something like that. He's the famous surfer. Mm. And there's a big statue to him in Waikiki right there. It's sort of the centerpiece of all of Waikiki.
Your head was very near his junk.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, I ended up looking 90 feet tall.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are.
Yeah. But
well, that's lovely. I don't expect the ladies will be in Omaha anytime soon. So, yeah.
Well, they're currently over on the Big Island, which is where we're going this weekend. So we may end up stumbling into them over the weekend. And I say I emphasize stumbling.
Yeah. Oh, so they'll be drunkenness.
Could be. Yeah.
Well, I'm still extremely sober, and I'm losing weight like I've got cancer, so.
That's good.
Yeah.
Really? How much weight have you lost?
18 pounds in less than a month.
Good God. That's like Rush Limbaugh weight loss.
It's cannot be healthy.
Yeah.
Like, fuck it.
That's like gastric bypass weight loss.
Yeah, it is. Well, the first 10 is just maker's mark. That's the first 10 is just no maker's mark.
Yeah.
Like anytime I stop drinking, it's an immediate 10 pound loss. Just boom. Mm-hmm. And that all comes out of my face and the bags under my eyes and the jowliness and the red nose, the W.C. Fields nose.
Yeah.
All of that weight is concentrated in my big fat face. Mm-hmm. And then the rest just comes off of, the other parts. And it's like a pound and a half, 2 pounds a day. Just wham, wham, wham. It's fucking outstanding.
Great. Well, I think that's excellent. That's such great news, because I was kind of concerned. What's it? Yeah, no. Good.
Give a shit.
Whatever works. But I did have, I've had this ongoing thing on the outline for the show. I was every week I just jot down just like one or two word items that we could talk about in the course of the show. That's about the extent of the planning that goes into a regular show. And at the end, there's one that I always type up that we never, ever get to. But it's like one of those things that we, if there's nothing else to talk about, I can always go, well, what has Elvis quit these days?
So what have I quit?
What has he quit doing? And so for a while there, you had started drinking again. So I thought that perhaps we could talk about how you've quit, at some point, when are you going to quit? And so we could actually begin to talk about those things. But so now you actually have quit, which is good.
I haven't had a drink in 6 weeks,
but you're still going to have an occasional drink. Or are you one of those people who just feel, if you ever have a drink, then it's just going to, you're just going to backslide.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not a, yeah. Yeah. I'm not a, it's very much a Leo McGarry thing where if I, I don't just have one drink, I have all of them. So I'm just going to stay clear of that, until whenever. I have a feeling I'm going to lose my job here pretty soon. So I'm saving up for that.
Oh, good. Really? Really? Yeah. Oh shit.
Yeah. Well, so my company got bought, and, so the integration has, happened for everybody but my tier of employee. So all the management above us has been done. But what has to happen now is that we all have to get basically hired fresh from this company. So it's not like apparently HR now is going through everybody's junk, and that can't bode well. Because, we've just been living, as a company, we've just been, you sign off on these various, the standards of conduct and stuff like that, codes of code. You sign off on all that, but you never really pay any attention to it, and your managers never hold you accountable to it. And now this company is like run by a bunch of holy rollers and Jesus freaks and stuff. So have a feeling they're not going to be asking me back. So that will be really interesting, right on top of a move and everything else.
Yeah,
so.
Good timing. Good timing.
Yeah, saving up for that. And then I will be drinking every drop that I get my hands on.
Good God. Yeah. I mean, it's, I was going to say, I mentioned this before on the show, that it appears as though you're kind of reaching the light at the end of the tunnel with your real estate fiasco.
Oh yeah. And I've already got a place and I'm moving stuff into it.
Oh, no way. Really? Are you in Iowa?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I mean, I'm still in the basement of the Farm of Doom right now, but it's I've got the keys to a place now, and It's beautiful. It's in a lovely little neighborhood, and it's, you know, it's just right.
So. Oh, that's great. See, now we're going to, you know what, a couple of things here. First of all, I wanted to ask, well, I have several questions. First of all, are you renting or buying?
No, renting out
there. Renting, okay.
The time being. But, you know, I spent a long time with the owner of the place, and the guy just owns it like as a tax write-off. It's the perfect situation. He doesn't give a shit about it. I mean, he has no emotional ties to it. He's getting a divorce, and he cashed out a bunch of government farm money. He got this big farm deal where the government throws money at you to do something or not do something. So he had this big windfall, and if he had just taken it out in cash, he would have had to pay a bunch of taxes on it. So he invested it. And in this house, so he's just going to rent it, and but eventually, basically, I'm hoping to just do like a land deal with him where I just take over the payments, where it's not a go through a bank thing, but we just, you know, do an ownership, you know, just a contract, and that way, I, you know, eventually becomes mine. So
now, sitting in at the Farm of Doom, now, does it feel especially dismal?
It feels especially who gives a fuck, Like, it's pouring down rain, and the lawn is going – is turning into something that Indiana Jones might find an idol in, you know? Like, it's just – it's, like, really going to seed, and I just don't give a flying fuck.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and then the final –
I mean, I'm not going to trash the place. I'm not going to strip the copper out of the place, but it's – you know, I'm certainly not losing any sleep over it like I used to.
And again, you're just walking away. You're going to leave
I mean, I'm going to try and short it. If I can, I mean, it's on the market.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah.
But there's absolutely, there's just no chance in fucking hell. I mean, somebody might stop by and offer me $50 for it. But, I mean, just so much has gone wrong in the last 7 years with various parts of it that I'm not hopeful.
Yeah. The disclosure form is going to be a mile long, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. The shorter form is the, you know, what don't you have to disclose? Like, look, let's just assume that this house will treat you like the one in Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. Let's do that. Like, it will actively try and murder you.
Yeah.
And then everything else, you know, radon is nothing to worry about when your house tries to actively murder you.
Well, here's a preview. Back in January, this was my real estate agent was the picture of ebullience. I mean, just upbeat, we're going to do open house, and we're going to sell this thing, and it's going to go. We're going to sell, get you the price you want, and boom. And I spoke with her the other day. And I called
her,
and
she's
like,
"Fuck that house."
She must have seen me on caller ID because she's like, "Hello."
Uh oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I said, "Are you okay?" She said, "Yeah. Okay. Yeah." So that's the disintegration of the real estate agent mood from January until now, when my house in Pennsylvania is pretty much doomed. You know. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's it occurs to me now that we're really now going to have to change the opening of the show.
Yeah, Hawaii and Iowa, man.
Yeah, get it's buzz. Hawaii and Iowa.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yep,
we're the it'll be the two states with the most vowels per capita. Although I think Mississippi is up there.
No, Mississippi's got a shitload of consonants.
Yeah,
MI, crooked letter I, humpback, crooked letter, crooked letter I.
Yeah. Yeah,
humpback guy, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. We got a bunch of vowels in a row, is what Iowa and Hawaii.
Hawaii. Sarah Vowell's new book is all about Hawaii. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. Is it?
Yep.
Have you read it?
I downloaded it to my Nook. I have an e-reader now, and I love the shit out of it. It's awesome.
Mm, good.
My little Nook, my Nook Color, as Peanut calls it. Daddy, can I borrow the Nook Color? You got a Nook Color? So I got a bunch of Peanut books on there. She reads 10 times faster on that thing just because of the novelty of it, or it's really easy on the eyes or something. But like, I'm watching, so I'm sitting at the kitchen, I'm sitting at the table working on something. I'm watching The Daily Show, and Albert Brooks is on, and he's pushing his new book. And I go, oh, I didn't even know he had a book. So I pick up my Nook right there, and I go beep, bop, boop, and there it is, and boom, I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
Can't beat that.
That's great.
I'm treating it like it's brand new technology that no one's ever heard of.
You know, I'm looking forward to the day when I can transfer all of my DVDs to a handheld device.
Yeah, because... or at least a, you know, a draw. You know, our good friend God is Dead, from Twitter at God is Dead, wrote a really interesting essay about on a blog about the death of spinning media. You know, rotating media. Like, why are we even still fucking with DVDs at this point? Why isn't it all solid state? He's absolutely right. You know, no media should rotate anymore.
Yeah. You know? Anything with working parts. Anything with
right, exactly.
Actual
Why do I own something
inside?
That has a spindle? Yeah. I don't care that the laser, it's a laser instead of a needle. Why do I have anything that has a rotating, that's, you know, that's fucking 100-year-old technology.
It really is.
I just want, everything should just be at, you know, at will, on demand, solid state, and done. I don't want to own, and that's what I've been doing. That's the great thing about this. The reason I got the Nook, what I did was I took about 90% of my print library in, it took me 6 trips of a completely full car, full of bags of books, but about 90% of my print library went to the Half Price bookstore.
Oh my God.
And I took all of that cash. I mean, some of it was a shit ton of cash, but I took some of it and just put it right into a Nook. I mean, I took the cash. The last batch I took was $275 in cash. Jesus. I took that in my little hand. I walked right over to Barnes & Noble, bought a Nook, and you know, now I'm going to start build up my library on one device instead of 7,000 pounds of books.
Yeah, you know? See, now so, I would have to have for the DVDs is the ability to rip them onto this device, like just like I can rip, I was able to rip my entire CD collection into iTunes and yeah. then have it on my iPod as well, and also my iPhone. You know, I want to be able to do that with my DVDs and not have to worry about having all this shit because you know I shipped all of my DVDs here to where I live now,
yeah, and so ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, so what I basically had to do was find you know new shelving for it. Instead, what I did actually, we don't have room for shelves in here for the DVDs, so I had to get a bunch of bins. And yeah. flat bins that all slide under the bed. And so, yeah. so you know, but it's just all such bullshit. I shouldn't have to do that anymore. They should right. be, they should have the DVD iPod at this point. Where all,
well,
all you
I mean,
have
they
to
do. Yeah. But if you, you know, if you want to sacrifice quality and sound and everything, I mean, I want, what I want to do, and I've started this process, but I've got a 1.5 terabyte drive. And I got Amersoft DVD ripper, which is like a $30 or $40 ripper, and that thing will tear the shit out of a disc. I mean, it'll rip content like you wouldn't believe. And then have it all digitally, just a couple, you know, one file, and you know, transfer it over to this terabyte drive and plug that shit into my entertainment center. Mm-hmm. And then I've got, I mean, that's a shit ton of movies right there, a 1.5 terabyte drive. So, yep. But that's what I want to do that to my entire. I don't want to have any physical media. I just want it all on one drive.
No. I mean, I don't even want
it networked throughout my entire house.
I didn't even retrieve my CDs. I mean, my entire music collection is now digital, which I have quadruple backups of.
Yeah.
I've got a Carbonite backup. Oh shit. You know what? I want to bleep that because I don't want to give them any advertising because they advertise on or they have advertised on Glenn Beck.
Oh right.
So,
yeah,
but
you didn't
suffice
say
to say,
their name last time.
Yeah, so suffice to say, I use a an online backup service, and then I have backup hard drives. I've got 2 internal hard drives that I use, and so it's protected
To an extent.
Yeah, to an extent. So, I mean, if they all go at once, I'm screwed. But yeah. I think that the likelihood of that happening is very slim. So,
no, as long as you've got something out in the cloud, you're all right.
Yeah. But I just need one for DVDs, and that's what I'm just waiting for that. This is the iPod that can contain my entire, because I've got my record collection on an iPod, and it's only taking up a third of the, it's a massive iPod.
Right.
It's only taking up a third of it. So, yeah. I mean, I need an iPod that would, like a DVD iPod that would contain my entire collection. I've got probably 900 DVDs.
Oh, good shit. I thought I had a lot.
Yeah, no, I've got a lot.
Well, I want to get to the point where, I mean, Netflix has really got the idea. I don't know if they're going to be, if they can keep going financially. Like, I don't know if their model is financially sustainable with the prices they're, with the money they're spending on rights for streaming. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, 10 years from now or however long, there's got to be a Netflix, if not Netflix, a Netflix-like streaming provider that is either a studio or a conglomeration or something where everything is on demand and streamable when I want it. So I don't have to, instead of going to my DVD shelf and going, oh, I want to watch Fargo tonight, I just boot something up and stream it and it's high quality. You know, I don't need Blu-ray quality streaming if it's, but I'd like, you know, some nice kind of, not granulated and pixelated and all that, but that's what I want. I want everything just immediately bandwidth available from somebody else's hardware farm. That's the model that we should be aiming for.
Yeah, Netflix is great, and you know, if you can, you know, if you can wait to get certain things, it's especially good.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to get to the point where I just don't, where there's no movie that's so fucking badass awesome that I have to own it anymore. I mean, but I do have a handful. I mean, there's some that I absolutely couldn't do without. But.
See, I'm one of those guys. The movies that I like, I don't mind watching them over and over again.
Oh no! Mostly all I do is the movies I like watching. I mean, like Raiders of the Lost Ark. I will watch that a couple times a month just because it gives me a warm, fuzzy glow. And you know, it's not even out on Blu-ray yet, fuckers.
And I, you know, there's something comforting about looking down on the shelf and seeing the entire, all seven seasons of The West Wing sitting there in a nice, colorful row.
Yeah, exactly.
In the W section.
I just gave God Is Dead my entire season one on disc, and I told him he could keep it because I ripped it all, and I've got the entire season one of West Wing on like seven different computers throughout the house and on my PS3, so I can watch it just on demand bam, I gotta watch Lies, Damn Lies, and Statistics. I gotta, right now, boom,
right on your TV on a stick in the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. But it's it's super convenient that way. I just go to my PS3 and boop boop boop, and I don't have to go hunting discs because I got those discs all over the place and I never find them.
Yeah,
it's much easier just to have it all digitized.
Yeah, it really is. It really is, and just to be able to not have to worry about, you know, I even considered putting all the, like, popping them all out of the cases and putting them in one of those booklets that have little slots in them.
That never works.
No, it doesn't. And it's impossible then to browse and see, you know, because usually how I do it is I look and I see the spines of all the DVDs, and whichever one sort of really grabs my attention is, that's the one I want to look at.
Yeah.
And it's some sort of forced feedback between the colorful or the colors of the spine of the DVD or the logo of it that just grabs my attention, makes me want to, it especially makes me want to watch something that I'm already in the mood to watch. So.
Yep. Yeah, like I'm scanning my shelves right now, and like Amelie, that French movie, Amelie.
Oh yeah, great movie.
Jumps out, great movie, great box. The box is a work of art.
Yeah,
so that's jumping out at me right now. So just based on that spine, I would pull that out and watch it right now.
Yeah,
love that movie.
I
love any French movie. I just love to put it on and close my eyes and just translate in my head, and it makes me instantly fall asleep for some reason.
People don't know that about you. I mean, you speak fluid French. Fluent French.
Enough so that I could get around. Like, I got engaged in Paris, and that was, you know, I was able to you know, parlez-vous enough to get by. But it's like any skill; it rusts over time. Certainly not using a lot of French here in fucking, you know, Nowheresville, Nebraska. But I like to listen. You know, I've got a handful of favorite French movies, especially the guy that whose name I can't remember now that did Amelie. But yeah, I love foreign movies. They're so, it's just a completely different vibe. Mm-hmm. Foreign movies, because like they only make like four a year. You know, like we're crap turning out all this crap, and these foreign movies are just making really good movies.
Yeah, the movie I watched just recently, it was one of those ones that I've seen several times. It's not even a feature film. It's a documentary. It's the documentary Lost in La Mancha, about Terry Gilliam trying to make Don Quixote.
Oh yeah, that's a great movie.
And he tried to do it in Spain with European
Johnny
money.
Depp, wasn't it?
With Johnny Depp, yeah, and it was just a disaster. If you want to see a movie about a documentary about how fucked up a movie making process can become, and then just really feel bad for Terry Gilliam, this is the movie. I mean, it was like everything stacked up against this guy. Yeah. There was some sort of, I don't know, some sort of karma.
Yeah,
in the air.
it was
literally cursed. It was he could not. Nothing was allowing him to make that movie. Just it's heartbreaking.
I'm surprised Gilliam gets major studio funding the way he does for his movie, because his movies are so weird and so uncommercial. Typically, you know, the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus and all these. It was just like, I love his movies. I love his vision. I love his style, and you know, just this crazy, crazy thing that he does. But I'm just surprised that studios continue to give him money to do them.
I mean, Munchausen was a disaster.
You didn't like Munchausen?
No, I love Munchausen. I just said the process of making that movie was a disaster.
Yeah.
That's what, I mean, he nearly went insane making that movie.
I love the movie.
I think it was something like $11 million over budget at one point, and it wasn't even finished.
Oh, I can believe it. It looked like a big movie.
Yeah, it was a huge movie. It was just, what happened was, and this is all explained in Lost in La Mancha, a must-see movie.
Yeah.
What happened was, the producer said that there was all kinds of money in the budget that it wasn't actually there. That's what it seems like. It seems like promises were made to Gilliam in terms of what he could do, the scope of what he could do, and it wasn't there. It wasn't possible. Had a wonderful lunch with Bubble Genius, the official sponsor of the Bob and Elvis Show.
Mm-hmm.
They're here in Hawaii, and they of course brought me soap.
Do they smell like soap?
They smell like soap.
Do they?
Absolutely. We could tell just blocks away. I smell hibiscus soap. And it was the Bubble Genius lady. So if you want the best soap in the goddamn world, go to bubblegenius.com. Soap, bath and body products, and even fun political products. It's all there at bubblegenius.com. It's the best place, easily the best place, to do all of your gift shopping. And as soon as they're done here in Hawaii, they'll be back to shipping all of your soap to you. So, meanwhile, they left us with a commercial. So there is a commercial from Bubble Genius this week, and here we go with that right now. You know, I always sound like Joe Franklin.
Yeah.
Here we go right now. Remember that? They used to do a sketch on Saturday Night Live. Yeah. Here it is right
with,
now.
With Billy Crystal.
Yeah. Yep. Here it comes right now, a special word from... such and
Wasom
such.
Wasom and matzah. God, that's good matzah.
Raymond Burr's nipple rouge.
Yeah.
Matzos by Streitz for the unleavened experience of a lifetime.
The experience of a lifetime, my friends.
Martin paints, it ain't just paints.
Right.
That's all coming back to me now.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. It's the guy that you start talking about. It.
I gotta find that sketch. That's so funny. So goddamn. But that whole season of SNL. Anyway, here's a new commercial from Bubble Genius.
Hey, man. How you do... what's that smell?
Don't talk to me. I'm studying for my Shakespeare final.
When was the last time you had a shower?
No time.
Days? Weeks? Is that a pile of empty Red Bull cans in the corner?
I have to ace this.
I think I can help you. The course of true love never did run smooth.
Hey, what's that?
It's Bubble Genius's Smart Cookies Literary Quote Fortune Cookie Soaps. You can educate yourself and get clean at the same time. Win-win.
That's awesome. I'm going to have a shower right now.
Smart Cookie. I'm going to open a window, okay?
Next week is Reading is Fun Week. Celebrate with Smart Cookies. 8 crystal clear mini fortune cookie soaps with a literary quote embedded inside. Great for your next Scrabble party.
BubbleGenius.com.
Shove Bob and Elvis into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go.
Do it.
Subscribe to the Bob and Elvis Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
Did you notice? You can always tell that Bubble Genius is of our generation because the college dorm music was like grunge music from 1991.
Yeah.
That's great. And by the way, if you want to purchase all of your soaps from Bubble Genius, and you goddamn well ought to be, put in your promo code Bob and Elvis, BOBANDELVIS, and get 15% off your entire order from www.bubblegenius.com. Yeah, that season of SNL, that was the 1984 season with Billy Crystal and Christopher Guest and Martin Short and Julia Louis-Dreyfus and, God, I mean, just one of the...
Brad Hall.
Easy. And Brad Hall was actually the host of... he did the Weekend Update.
Yeah, that's right.
Which at the time they called it... They didn't even call it Weekend Update in that season. They called it Saturday Night News.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, and Rich Hall. Rich Hall was also.
Oh, yeah. Rich Sniglets.
Hall. Sniglets.
Rich Hall.
That's right. And there was...
Oh, but the little skits that Billy Crystal and Christopher Guest would do together, like the taped stuff, and Martin Short. Remember that character Martin Short did where they'd have Harry Shearer come on as the 60 Minutes guy.
Oh, yeah.
And he would interview Martin Short as nervous, smoking, like, corporate goon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
that skit just always killed me. They did it a couple of times.
Oh, God. Now I'm trying to think of the catchphrase from that character. Yeah. I used to know all the names of all those characters. It's like,
oh, yeah.
God, I mean, there was such a treasure trove of great sketches. There was, was the character Nathan Thurm?
Yes.
Was that the attorney's name was Nathan
Thurm?
And he would
just turn all the questions back on the interview. No, I'm not. Yes, no, I'm not. You are. It's just this great, just the unbelievable talent.
All sweaty
in
and
exactly.
Sweaty just, and chain smoking, and
yeah,
so like it was like a 60 Minutes expose on this novelty toy company.
Novelty toy, that's right.
And Harry Shearer is Mike Wallace saying, you know, so and so from Tulsa, Oklahoma, suffered severe bruising on her upper thighs from sitting on one of your defective whoopee cushions.
Exactly.
Yeah, they did lots of like.
You're sounding a little defensive. No, I'm not. You are. Why is it always the other person who's being defensive?
and you know, one of my favorite sketches, it wasn't a regular character, but they did it a couple of times, was a character that Martin Short brought over from SCTV, which was Jackie Rogers Jr.
Oh, yeah. $100,000
jackpot. $100,000
jackpot
wad.
Funniest one with Christopher Guest as the kind of gay guy.
Yeah,
Djibouti, that guy.
Yeah.
And Captain Kangaroo. Jim Belushi was Captain Kangaroo.
That's right.
And Billy Crystal was Sammy Davis Jr. And what's her face was just some woman. Mary Gross was some woman. And it was. $100,000 jackpot was the funniest goddamn skit I've ever seen in my life.
It really, really is.
Chocolate babies.
Yeah.
Laugh at that.
And what was the prize? It's a car. It's a shiny car. It's a red shiny car.
That and the time that Jesse Jackson did the question.
Oh no, that was the prize from the question. That was the car was the prize from the question.
Who gets the car? I get the car.
It does not matter. The question is moot.
The question is moot. So
that was the answer to all the quiz questions.
Because Jesse Jackson just had some bullshit political flim-flam to say about it. So they'd ask a question, and he'd go, the question is moot.
It does not matter.
Back when they had something to say politically, when it was actually sharp and well-written.
Right.
You know? Because now, I don't understand what they're doing now. Like, they tried to riff on the presidential, on the GOP debate, and it was sackless. I mean, they don't seem to understand irony or satire anymore.
No,
they don't seem to get it. When it was because the GOP field is so ludicrous and these people are so stupid in real life that the only way to mock them is to make a GOP debate skit where they're fucking super geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only way to spin that, the only way to turn that on its ear and make it funny is to lambast the press and make the GOP contestant, you know, people at the make them geniuses and shame the press or do something. But the way they did it, it's like, well, yeah, that's what it was. A clown show.
Yeah.
It was so bad. I'm like, how can you fuck this up? Don't you have any people? And Tina Fey was the guest star. That it's like, doesn't she? She seems pretty smart and funny.
Yeah.
Well, I don't understand why a staff of 75 people can't write a fucking funny skit for, you know, 3 minutes.
There's no satire anymore. It's just impressions.
No.
It's just like, this is, oh, that sounds exactly like him. That's funny. He
right.
kind of does say that.
Like,
yeah.
Let's just do what it is and hope that what it is has laughs in it.
Yeah.
That's not satire. That's not social commentary.
Mm-hmm.
That's just pointing a camera at something.
Right.
It pisses me off.
God. Yeah, I mean,
look at what the original cast would do, the kind of stuff they would get away with that you would never get away with today.
Yeah.
The sort of, I mean, Saturday Night Live was the test tube for social commentary. I mean, someone like Andy Kaufman could never get on TV today, like on a Saturday Night Live. I mean, Saturday Night Live in the old days, the original Lorne Michaels, the original 70s Saturday Night Live was just an absolute incubator for genius.
Yeah.
Because they had the sack and they didn't give a shit and they were all snorting cocaine and it was awesome. Now it's like how many truly talented people can we kill on this show? All they care about now is maybe one or two Will Ferrells will show up and go on to be you know, characters that they can launch into movie stardom.
Yeah.
And that's pathetic, if you ask me.
Yeah, there's it just doesn't seem like it's that launching pad anymore for great. It doesn't. They're not even any great characters,
right?
At least that I'm aware of.
I can't think of any.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you remember even during the sort of the Mike Myers, Dana Carvey years, there was a new group of characters that were coming out of that show, going on to make movies.
Yeah,
on a regular basis.
Yeah,
and that doesn't happen anymore.
No.
And I mean, it doesn't even matter. I mean, that's almost superficial to even mention that, because what it comes down to, what made Saturday Night Live great was its ability. There was a subversive element to it where it was on the not ready for primetime players. That was all a statement about being on network commercial television and undermining the system from within.
Yeah, right.
That was the whole idea of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. And now Lorne Michaels couldn't be a bigger corporate chode.
Yeah.
Chode. Right? I mean, now he is the system. It's like George Lucas.
Yeah.
Is, you know, when George Lucas made Star Wars, he was the anti-studio, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he wanted to do it his way. He had a vision and ba-da-da. Now he is the system.
Yeah.
His own system, and it's for fuck. Mm-hmm. It's the same with Lorne Michaels. He's absolutely just like a godfather figure now. What he says goes. I don't know who's picking the talent over there and by what criteria. But it's just not funny.
Yeah. And, you know, I hear some people say, well, it's a generational thing. Yeah, you don't understand. No. The younger kids who watch late night television now, maybe the college students now who are 20 years younger than you, Bob, you know, they get it. You don't because it's a different generation. It's a, there's a generational gap. And that's utter bullshit. Yeah, because
comedy is comedy.
And save for the 1 year that Anthony Michael Hall was on, I watched Saturday Night Live religiously and loved it from like 1981 through about 1998.
Yeah.
I mean,
and then it just went right off the map.
It just went right off the map. There was that gray area
that it was one or two seasons where you could not name one member of that cast. Like wasn't fucking Robert Downey Jr. on Saturday Night Live?
Robert Downey Jr., that was the year with Anthony Michael Hall.
Yeah,
that was the year.
That is just a bizarre lineup that they had then.
Right. That was, I think it was either Brandon Tartikoff's last year or Lorne Michaels' first year back.
We're trying to
after
do
leaving
something
the job.
Really weird.
Yeah. And so it was
like, skewed at this really fucked up demographic.
Exactly. And I remember Pee Wee Herman hosting that season. I think Joan Cusack was on the show that season. It was a strange, strange, weird season. And it was right after the one that we were just talking about, which was the Christopher Guest, Billy Crystal season. And when that entire cast, the whole cast went
just
away
up and left
after that season, even the bit players, you know, sort of the Jim Belushi, Gary Kroger group.
Yeah, Gary Kroger. Yeah,
even Gary Kroger had a great character. Remember, he did a character on the news where he was the film strip narrator.
Oh, right, yeah.
Anyway,
you'd bring out the little old-school film strip machine and...
He'd like smack his lips together and make that warbly sound from the bad film strip cassettes.
Yeah, that was all right. And Tim Kazurinsky, yeah.
They were just solid players,
and it was more about the writing. I mean, it wasn't... this is a show that couldn't figure out how to use Chris Rock, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, Chris Rock did not use Saturday Night Live as a launch pad. He left that fucking show, and it took him years to build up enough cred in the comedy circuit to get an HBO special, and that's how he really took off.
Yeah.
Was with his HBO special. I mean, they just could not figure out what to do with Chris Rock because he was light years, even as a teenager, he was light years ahead of where they were willing to be with social commentary.
Yeah.
They're just ballless now. It's a ballless organization. Well, I could kick the door down in that place and have it back on its feet in 48 hours if they wrote me a check and said, just do whatever, Elvis. Just bring a sack of balls. Sack full of balls.
That's right.
Because British comedy has never, ever lost that thing. Because British comedy is almost entirely about social commentary and class, tearing down class infrastructure, right? I mean, that's the whole point of it, because Brits are just so tight-assed and smug and pitiful. And so they've never lost that, just year after year after year. And we started the show with The Office, and there's never been anything more insanely brilliant, and they just know how to do it. You know, two seasons, done.
Yeah.
Two seasons, done.
Mm-hmm.
We never, because the only reason to put a series, a television show on the network today in America is to get it syndicated, to make the big fat syndication money.
So they have to go, they have to go five. To go,
what, like 100 episodes?
I think it's, yeah, I think it's something like five seasons or maybe, I don't know if it is 100 episodes. I think it is. I think you're right.
Eight seasons now you can get into syndication. Yeah. It's, the bar is way lowered. But that's the only thing. It's longevity now. It's not quality, it's longevity.
Yeah.
In scripted television. I mean, everything's fucking reality shows now. But, you know, that all they care about is longevity and syndication money, which immediately starts to eat into the quality, especially in comedy. I mean, comedy is just not some, it just, other than like, you know, Cheers was continually good, I think, from start to finish. I really, I don't think it had, you know, but MASH, I mean, there are definitely comedies that just fell off hugely in their later years.
Yeah. Yeah,
just because that's all they care about in America is just keep going. And in Britain, I mean, look at The Office, two seasons, 8 episodes each, right? 16 episodes total.
Mm-hmm.
And Fawlty Towers, same way.
Yeah.
There's only 12 episodes of Fawlty Towers. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's 12 Office. 12 episodes of The Office.
Yeah.
6 each. That's astonishing if you think about it.
Yeah, and it just so eats into. I mean, you go that long. Even Seinfeld, the last season or so, was kind of. It just became like a parody of itself.
I would say when Larry David left, it went completely in the toilet.
Yeah,
I mean, it's still the worst. Seinfeld is still better than anything else, really.
Of course, right.
But as compared to say season 3 and 4, like the opera and the contest, those episodes. Could not hold a candle to the best of the best. Mm-hmm. When they had what's his face from Borat, that Larry Charles, writing and directing and producing, mm-hmm. and Larry David. As soon as Larry David left, it lost its focus completely.
That's right. But
these bizarre tangents and these fucking ridiculous coincidences and circumstances. You're like, what?
Yeah,
it's not. The show is about anymore. Now it's suddenly about something.
Yeah.
Before it was just a couple, you know, just people just hanging out and talking, and suddenly it became very, very plot oriented, mm-hmm. where every character had to have his or her balanced screen time, and it just became ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that the circumstances almost became supernatural. I mean, almost supernaturally weird.
Yeah, exactly. In New York, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Like you run into people like that in New York, a city of, you know, 6 million people or 8, whatever it is. It became ludicrous. You just had, I mean, it was almost like theater of the bizarre. Like you really had to take it all with a huge grain of salt.
Yeah, and it's a funny episode, but the thing that strikes me as being exemplary of that over the top, like really trying too hard to do the bizarre Seinfeld plot was actually when Jerry snatches that marble rye out of the hands of that old lady. Right. Give me that rye, old bat. And he said, like, rips it out of her hand and goes running down the street, holding it like a football.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't seem, it seemed so far beyond, so off the rails of what would actually have happened on the show even two seasons earlier.
Yeah. And then having to fish it with a fishing pole out the window.
Pole,
it's just like, come on.
Right. It became almost like a Lucy plot, you know, where it just gets so weird and contrived. But even that show, on its worst day, they never did a very special wedding episode where Jerry and Elaine.
There's not a single Christmas episode.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, the worst Seinfeld's better than 90% of what's on today. Yeah.
But then, I mean, the American version of The Office, even they did a wedding episode, didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't watch that show.
Babies and no, I stopped watching it early this season when the writing seemed like when literally it seemed like every character was being written by someone who had never seen the show. I was like, what is going on here? This is not Michael Scott would never say that. He would never do that. And I was talking to some friends of mine. I was like, they're like, yeah, I can't watch it either. It's awful. But apparently the quality has picked up for the last couple episodes where Will Ferrell's come in. So.
Speaking of shows, I think our listeners, all 9 of them, are going to are just shouting at their iPods right now, going, "Isn't this a political show? You guys talking about shows that have fallen off the rails? You guys are talking about television for the last 40 minutes."
That's right. You know what I have to say to them? Fuck you. My show. I'll talk about whatever the fuck I want to talk about. And frankly, nothing happened this week, so suck it.
Yeah. Well, Meatloaf, are we allowed to talk about whatever the fuck we want to talk about?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Meatloaf is meatloaf the said ultimate we, yeah. arbiter of our content.
It's the Meatloaf Magic 8 Ball. You can just ask Meatloaf anything you want.
Yeah. Well, so there's immigration. Obama's making the rounds of the southern states. Looking, he's trying to sweep Texas now. There was a pathetic debate where people raised their hands in favor of torture. You know, at some point, what are you going to say?
It is.
What are you going to say?
It is a light week, but there were some things that I wanted to touch on in the course of the show. And but, you know, I mean, the way the show goes is it's not. We don't sit and we don't say, you know, we don't have a prep meeting before each show and go, okay, at exactly 6 minutes after, we're going to segue into the John McCain speech. And then at approximately 12 minutes after, we're going to segue into this. The show is wholly and entirely spontaneous.
Yeah.
It's like we start at point A and we kind of know when the show is going to end and what happens at the end. And we know there's a couple of things where we talk about bubble genius in there. And then everything that happens around that, I have no blessed clue what's going to happen.
Nor do I.
And so that's, I think
obviously
that's
just phone it in.
Yeah, and that's I think that's part of the charm of the show. Though I could be delusional about that. I don't know. But suffice to say, I don't see anyone in the comments saying, you know what, fuck you guys. You can need to talk about politics starting at second one and keep going until second 90, and then talk about this other thing. What, you know, if I saw that, I'd probably still ignore it. But, I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing a demand that we talk about politics the whole time. And needless to say, there are going to be weeks in which either there's not a lot going on in politics. I'm not going to manufacture outrage if I'm not feeling particularly outraged about what's going on, even though there are certainly things that we could dig and search for that we could get pissed off about. I mean, there were a couple of things this week. I mean... First of all, I thought John McCain was outstanding. I don't know if you saw John McCain's speech.
Yeah,
on the floor
coming
of the
out
Senate.
against torture and trying to set the record straight. I think it's the great redemption. You know, maybe the tail end of the John McCain tragedy is that he redeems himself in some way on this issue.
Well, I was going to play the whole speech, and we're going to kind of parse apart the speech, but we're running short on time.
Yeah,
so I was just going to go to the excerpts here. And like he says, I mean, this is sort of the meat of what McCain says. Though Osama bin Laden is dead.
Oh,
see, I almost did it.
I almost did it.
God.
See?
Damn.
See?
God damn it.
Mr. High and Mighty, Mr. Never, never mixes those two up.
But this is, I was reading text and Mm-hmm. They used Osama in the text, so
nope.
I do have a little bit of wiggle room there. Though Osama bin Laden is dead, America remains at war. And to prevail in this war, we need more than victories on the battlefield. This is a war of ideas as well. A struggle to advance freedom in the face of terror in places where oppressive rule has bred the malevolence that feeds an ideology of violent extremism. Prisoner abuses exact a terrible toll on us in this war of ideas.
Nicely said.
I don't mourn the loss of any terrorist life, nor do I care if in the course of serving their malevolent cause they suffer great harm. They've earned
malevolent twice in one speech?
That's right.
Yeah. You might want to get out of thesaurus there, John.
They've earned their punishment in this life and the next. What I do mourn is what we lose by official policy or neglect we allow, confuse, or encourage those who fight this war for us to forget that best sense of ourselves, which is our greatest strength, that when we fight to defend our security, we also fight for an idea, not a land, not a tribe, not a king, not a twisted interpretation of an ancient religion, but an idea, that all men are endowed by their creator with inalienable rights.
Hmm.
That's shocking to see from John McCain.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's nice to see him not, you know, riding some bullshit political wave here and stand, you know, because he lost his way there on the torture issue for a while. And this is a guy that has fucking been tortured. So
yeah.
I really never understood his backpedaling there for political reasons. So, I hope in the twilight of his career, whenever that is, that he regains some small semblance of the honor he lost in 2008 and onward, because he's really just been acting like a petulant dick since he got clobbered.
Yeah.
And it's time for him to cut that bullshit out.
Well, if you go to politicalcorrection.org, that's the Media Matters That's the other Media Matters site, politicalcorrection.org. They have the whole speech on video. Huh. It's 20 minutes long.
Who did he give it to?
He just gave it on the floor of the Senate.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And he lays out in great detail exactly what they were able to ascertain about bin Laden, and he enumerates quite clearly that it wasn't ascertained as a result of harsh interrogation measures, including waterboarding.
Right.
John McCain, like every intelligence expert who I have heard from on television or in the press, is exactly right that it simply does not work. It doesn't work. And I'm still waiting for one conservative to point to one intelligence official or one military official who says that waterboarding and harsh interrogation is more effective and more expedient than standard interrogation techniques. They cannot produce. All they can produce is Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney with his Vader machine pumping his blood, his sand through his veins. Mm-hmm. That's all they can do. That's all they have. There is no.
I wouldn't give it, and nobody should give a shit if they could.
That's exactly right, because it doesn't matter.
If there were 200 ex-CIA guys that would say, hell yeah, it works, who gives a shit?
It does not.
It's morally repugnant. Right. It's not what we do.
And that was
it's
my next point.
It's against the fucking law.
Yeah. It's illegal, and it's immoral, and it runs entirely contrary to American values. It's just something we do not do. We prosecuted people in the past for waterboarding. And it's a
ludicrous argument to be. It's a ludicrous thing to even be talking about.
Yeah.
We don't torture people. We're just not fucking Nicaragua in the 1980s or El Salvador. What the fuck? I don't even understand why we're having this conversation. Yeah.
It doesn't. And the whether or not it works is irrelevant. It doesn't work, but it's irrelevant because it's illegal.
Right.
And
it's like the whole is Obama a Muslim thing.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant. It's fucking irrelevant in our system because there's no religious test for office. So fuck you.
So let's
separation of church and state.
Let's entertain the assertions of or the assertions of Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney.
Oh, barf.
And
I hate Liz Cheney.
And say that okay, they have suggested that information that was gleaned from torture in the 3 years from 2002 to 2005 that they were actually waterboarding led to the arrest of Osama bin Laden, or the murder, or whatever you want to call it, the killing of Osama bin Laden. Now their argument about torture is that if there's an impending attack on the way, that we want to use what.
The ticking time bomb.
Exactly. If there's the 24 scenario,
yeah,
they want to be able to torture in order to rapidly resolve that situation, to prevent that terrorist attack from happening. Well, if it was so goddamn expedient, then don't you think if they were torturing for 3 years to get the, and they had Abu Zubaydah, they had Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they had all of these high-ranking al-Qaeda officials. Don't you think if it was so fast and expedient a process that they would have had Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, like the next day.
The next day. It's not fast. It doesn't, because it doesn't work. It's just, it's an act of vengeance. It's some sort of weird bloodlust.
Of course.
It's like we want to beat the shit out of these guys. We don't care whether it works. We just want to get the satisfaction of kicking their asses around a little bit.
Sure. That's absolutely what it is.
It's just, again, much like the modern Republican Party in every issue, in every circumstance, it's a reaction to fear.
Yeah. It's a bullshit machismo. It's when you've got nothing else. I mean, I can understand why Cheney's still blowing this horn, because he's got to basically protect himself from potential war crimes prosecution. Mm-hmm. I mean, he should literally be in The Hague with a fucking 10-ton weight on his head, you know, like in the deepest, dankest cell of The Hague, rotting for war crimes, because he and his buddy, the under president, the actual Vice President Bush, that's why he's got to backpedal on all this. But it's a ridiculous argument that we're even having there's shades of gray, and the press, we're all complicit in this. At the minute those pictures from Abu Ghraib came out, the country should have gone insane, should have gone batshit crazy, and demanded courts martial and just a complete shakedown. We didn't, just nobody gave a shit. Nah, yeah. Fuck it. It's the bad guys. Torture them. 24, Jack Bauer. Woo.
That's right.
Because we're just so inured to it all.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, nobody gives a shit about human rights anymore.
No.
No, seriously. It's just, it's so distressing. It's so depressing that it just, oh, they're the bad guys. Like I told you about the kid in the kindergarten over here. Somebody asked him where his dad was, and he said he's over in Iraq killing the dirties.
Oh, good.
Yeah. A little, like a 5-year-old kid. He's over in Iraq killing the dirties. That's how it's been explained to this little boy, that he's over there killing the dirties. I'm like, oh my God, we're doomed.
We need a show. We need another Hawkeye Pierce on television. You want to dovetail
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Because Hawkeye was the sort of moral voice of the kind of conscience, American conscience you wanted in the middle of war.
Alan Alda's portrayal of Hawkeye Pierce, I think, helped America to heal from Vietnam.
Vietnam, yeah, because that's what MASH was ultimately about. It was set in Korea, but it was really about Vietnam.
It was.
Yeah. I mean, the show lasted longer than the fucking Korean War did.
Yeah.
No, it did.
The show lasted 11 seasons. Korean War was 2 years.
Right. I mean, I'm just saying it was absolutely a social commentary on the absurdity of war and Alden. I mean, he was an American hero and at the time, we needed that kind of healing first of all, but we were just a different people, a different sort of we're just pitiful now. There's no sacrifice anymore. There's no ownership of anything. Yeah. Oh, that's their problem. Somebody else's deal.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think I think a lot of it has to do with the dream world that a lot of people are living in. This false fairy tale, this ridiculousness, this mythology that half of America exists, and the Republican Party feeds on it.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they not only feed on it, they actually perpetuate it. They stir the pot. Right. And again, with regards to the torture argument, you heard Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney talking about how, once again, wheeling out this meme about how they were able to keep America safe for 8 years, following the biggest terrorist attack in the history of the United States, they were able to keep everybody safe and prevent terrorist attacks throughout the subsequent 8 years because of their policies of torture and illegal invasion. Mm-hmm. Right. So, which is, of course, a big lie. It's a big lie. You want to see, there was a great chart in The Economist. And I get The Economist now.
Oh, my God.
I get that magazine.
Fancy boy.
But I saw this great chart. And it listed all of the non-war zone Al-Qaeda attacks from 1992 to 1998. So 1992 in December in Yemen, hotel bombing. 1993, New York, World Trade Center bombing. 1993 also, Mogadishu, Somalia, ambush of U.S. forces. These are all Al-Qaeda attacks. 1994, June, Iran, Shia shrine bombing. 1995, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, truck bomb. 1998, Kenya and Tanzania, U.S. embassies bombed. 2000, October, Yemen again, USS Cole bombing.
Yep.
All right, that's the extent of the Clinton administration, during which they did not torture. They didn't conduct some ridiculous folly in invading another country that had nothing to do with any of this stuff.
Clinton's national security advisor and his, policy team came up with detailed plans to undo Al-Qaeda and go after those fuckers.
Yeah, but no war for Monica. That was the mantra from the Republicans.
Right.
So that was the Clinton administration. Just I listed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6... Seven Al-Qaeda attacks during the entire Clinton administration. Now, here are the Bush administration Al-Qaeda attacks. September, 9/11 attacks, 2001. 2002, April, Tunisia, synagogue bombing. May, 2002, Pakistan, hotel bombing. June, 2002, Pakistan, U.S. consulate bombing. 2002, October, Limburg oil tanker bombing. 2002, October, Indonesia, nightclub bombings. 2002, November, Kenya, hotel bombing. That was, okay, so there were as many terrorist attacks in 2002, and these are non-war zone attacks. You can't attribute them, well, we're at war, we were fighting them, and then they were attacking us back. No, this is non-Iraq, non-Afghanistan attacks. There were more attacks on Bush's watch in 2002 alone than the entire Clinton administration.
Yep.
And the Clintons didn't have to use torture. Meanwhile, Bush is torturing the shit out of people, and they're still attacking us. That's where they're attacking targets around the world.
Yeah.
You were talking about specific American soil attacks. Well, there were still more American soil attacks on Bush's watch than there were in Clinton's watch. So you got 2003, May, Saudi Arabia, expatriate bombing, compound bombing. 2003, May, Morocco, multiple bombings. 2003, August, Indonesia, hotel bombing. 2003, November, Saudi Arabia, car bombs. 2003, November, Turkey, synagogues bombed. 2004, February, Philippines, ferry bombings. 2004, March, Madrid, Spain, train bombings. 2004, April. Yeah, that was a really bad one.
Yeah.
Against a very close ally of the United States. 2004, April, Saudi Arabia, government building bombing. 2004, May, Saudi Arabia, refinery attack. 2004, May also, Saudi Arabia, expatriate compound attack. Again, I guess. 2004, December, Saudi Arabia, U.S. consulate attack. 2005, July, London, underground bus bombings.
Yeah, that was a bad one.
That was another bad one. 2005, July, Egypt, resort bombings. 2005, November, Jordan, hotel bombing. 2007, April, Algeria, car bombs. 2008, June, Pakistan, Danish embassy bombing. You know, if torture was so effective, you think they could have prevented one of these things?
Right. Right. One of them.
Yeah.
I mean, Bush's whole deal was, well, America's fine. The whole rest of the world's getting their nuts crushed, but, we're doing all right. Mm-hmm. Because that was the thing. I mean, we were just so utterly traumatized by 9/11 that who cares what terrorist attacks have been going on around the world forever. I mean, the real international unity of 9/11 came from countries like Israel and even England, with the IRA, these countries that have had intimate experience with terrorist attacks, felt some solidarity for us, some sympathy. And it's like, hey, we get it. Now you get it the way we get it, right? Those countries don't lose their fucking mind like we did after 9/11. Because they've lived with it for years and years. I mean, Israel kind of does. Israel's all about disproportionate response. I mean, that's Israel's thing. Yeah. But we just lost our fucking minds as a people, as a culture.
And it was all hocus pocus, too. We were just fed a bunch of hocus pocus. We were fed the idea that if, some small burg in Ohio is given, $10,000 worth of anti-terrorism gear, that it was going to keep them safe from terrorism, as if the Al-Qaeda was hiding under their beds, as if Al-Qaeda was really going to attack, Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, that's what they want. That's how they need to frame it, to get people to vote with their fear. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how you control a population, is make it sound like people in Ohio are going to get killed by Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
You had a better chance of winning the lottery while getting struck by lightning.
Exactly. So the mantra was they kept us safe for eight years, right?
Well, and that, and us, that it
was,
yeah, but
that it was, well, us, but not really. I mean, again, if you got to measure process versus result.
Yeah.
And during the Clinton years, there was one major terrorist attack, or one terrorist, let's say one Al-Qaeda attack. Let's talk about specifically Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorism. Let's bring it to a slightly broader definition. Islamic terrorism, one attack on Clinton's watch on American soil.
And
that was the World Trade Center bombing.
And almost, that didn't even hardly, well, that
a matter
like,
of
what,
weeks.
Four people?
Yeah, yeah. And it was only a matter of weeks after Clinton was sworn in for his first term. So it was really, I mean, and then you have no torturing happening. None of this, no Patriot Act or Department of Homeland Security or any of this insanity that we were subjected to for 8 years under Bush. Then you have, on Bush's watch, you have 9/11. Tremendous. Happened, you know, 8 months after Bush took office. You had people like Richard Clark screaming like a chicken with his head cut off, trying to get a meeting, had evidence. There was a PDB in August saying bin Laden's determined to attack, and nothing was done about it. Then this happened, and then everyone went batshit, and there were all these things. There was torture. There was invasion. There were two wars. There was a warrantless wiretapping. All kinds of crap. Extraordinary rendition happening. Yeah. All these terrible, terrible things. And there ended up being more terrorism. If you want to talk about terrorism on American soil, you had the D.C. snipers. You had the anthrax attacks. I think there are several others that I can't think of right now. I mean, if you look at some of the really Islamophobic websites, they actually list something like 10,000 terrorist attacks during the Bush administration. Except they don't blame, you know, they don't make the correlation because it's a far right, you know.
Yeah.
It was a far right Bush apologist site. Yeah, they actually, there's a website called Islam, the Religion of Peace.
Oh,
it's sort of affiliated with Michelle Malkin.
They're being ironic, I guess.
Exactly. And in 2008, their tally for Islamic terrorists have carried out more than blank deadly terror attacks since 9/11. At that point in 2008, since 9/11, 10,606 terrorist attacks around the world.
It's amazing how two sides of the same coin can come up with two completely separate and completely diametrically opposed conclusions about that.
Yeah.
Like, Bush can basically say zero, and the same ideology can produce a tally of, you know, 10,000 because they just hate Muslims so much.
Slightly to the right of Bush
Is
a difference of 10,000 terrorists.
Right. That's amazing.
It really
is. Islamophobia doesn't even begin to scratch the surface on these people. Just how... Oh, Sharia law! There's this thing in Tennessee where they're saying that any group of two or more Muslims represents a cabal, a threat, you know, a potential node of Sharia law. It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
that you're so. It's like my aunt. My aunt and uncle are really super holy rollers. They belong to one of these Christian cults. One of these, you know, really high-powered international Christian cults, and they called on 9/11 and said, my aunt said, well, it really makes you realize which is, you know, that the Christian God is the right God. And I'm like, really? Because right now it looks like Muhammad just kicked the shit out of us, basically. It's like Islam's winning right now, if you ask me. It's like, we're going to frame it like that. We're so fucked if you're going to frame it like this, you know, holy crusade, this end of the world ideology thing. Fucking hell. Yeah, this really makes me think about Jesus right now.
Well, you know, you just, they just can't be taken seriously at this point because there's no evidence pointing to the efficacy of any of this stuff. There's not even any evidence proving, there's evidence entirely the contrary about this whole, that we kept them safe. We kept you safe for 8 years.
Yeah.
It's probably the most flagrant lie in the modern Bush Republican arsenal of lies. I mean, it's just so obviously false. They kept us safe for 8 years.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The guy I voted for got Osama. So.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's good.
I win. I voted for that guy.
Right.
The guy I voted for got Osama bin Laden done.
Yep. And so that's that. I wrote a whole chapter about it in my book.
Yeah, you did.
I posted it on. If you go to my Twitter feed, I posted a link to that. You can download that chapter. My Twitter feed at twitter.com/BobSeska_go, which is the worst Twitter handle ever.
Ever. Yeah.
I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I had no idea. Someone else stole Bob Seska. I don't know who took my name on Twitter prior to me signing
up.
Maybe
there's another Bob Seska out there.
I think there is, apart from my dad, who's also Bob Seska.
Are you a junior?
No, because we have different middle names.
Ah.
Yeah. So it's not, I don't even get the benefit of junior.
Somewhere along a couple of years ago, I had to change the official spelling of my real middle name because evidence cropped up that I've been spelling it wrong all this time.
Really?
Yeah. It's a name that ends in an S, and the correct spelling is with two S's. So had to go and change that.
Did you see Newt Gingrich on Hannity last night?
Oh fuck no. I think I watch Hannity.
Well, I thought you might have seen a clip on the internet at some point.
No, Hannity makes me. I have such a Pavlovian response to seeing Hannity's gigantic head. I really like close to vomit inducing. I can't stand that fucking pinhead.
Yeah,
I swear to God, there's something. The moment I see him with his eyes too close together, the biggest punch me face ever.
Right, and here's what he said, and this is probably and what I had jotted down in my notes for today was simply the Southern strategy is back, as if it had ever gone away.
Oh, yeah, and it never went away.
Well, here it is. I mean, you want to talk about race baiting right here? Do you want to talk about dog whistles? Here you go.
Is this going to be about Common?
Newt Gingrich right here. No, it's not about Common. I don't give a shit about that story. But here's Newt Gingrich on Hannity last night with a big, stupid, shitty grin on his face with his helmet hair. If you look at the collapse of Detroit and the rise of Texas, and you say to yourself, which would you like better, the state that had the most job creation in the past 10 years, or a city which has collapsed? Talking to Governor Rick Perry and others, I know how to make the whole country look like Texas. President Obama knows how to make the whole country resemble Detroit.
Wait, Hannity said that?
No, Newt Gingrich.
Or Gingrich said that.
Presidential candidate Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
Newt Gingrich, who I'd like to point out, repeatedly, wrote a book fantasizing about the Confederates winning at Gettysburg and hence the Civil War.
Yeah.
That's all you really need to know about where Newt's coming from. That's the kind of fantasy he dabbles in. And this is the other one. By the way, speaking of fantasy, the fantasy that Texas somehow, with the brilliance of Rick Perry, extricated itself when other states could not. I mean, you want to talk about myth-making.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that Texas was essentially bailed out by the federal government.
Yeah.
With stimulus money. I mean, that's what they don't want to tell you that. They'd rather just credit it entirely to Rick Perry. But I mean, here's the story from back in January. Texas Governor Rick Perry likes to tell Washington to stop meddling in state affairs. He vocally opposed the Obama administration's 2009 stimulus program to spur the economy and assist cash-strapped states. Perry also likes to trumpet that his state balanced its budget in 2009 while keeping billions in its rainy day fund. But he couldn't have done that without a lot of help from, guess where, Washington. Turns out Texas was the state that depended the most on those very stimulus funds to plug nearly 97% of its shortfall for fiscal 2010, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Nice.
Texas, which crafts a budget every 2 years, was facing a $6.6 billion shortfall for its 2010-2011 fiscal years. It plugged nearly all of that deficit with $6.4 billion in Recovery Act, that stimulus money, allowing it to leave its $9.1 billion rainy day fund untouched. Untouched. So, Barack Obama bails out Texas. Rick Perry gets credit for it from race-baiting douchewad Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, and I'm not sure too many states, especially in New England, California, et cetera, would really go for the Texas model of success and thriving. When you look at their education numbers, when you look at some of their real social indicators, they're at the bottom of the fucking bag. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got the worst school system in the almost. I think they're only second or third to like Mississippi. I mean, it's a fucking disaster over there. Their social infrastructure. I mean, they're right on the border of just collapsing.
Yeah.
As far as infrastructure. I mean, so yeah, I'm not sure anyone wants to call Texas out as a model for state behavior. They got the fattest, like, two or three cities in the world, in the country. Houston, one of the fattest fucking cities in the country. They got horrible health they're just awful. It's just an awful, awful state.
Yeah.
So yeah, enjoy that.
Even as Perry requested the Recovery Act money, he railed against it. On the very same day he asked for the funds, he set up a petition titled "No Government Bailouts." I mean, it's you know, they're Mark's again the half of the country thinks these guys are just, you know, the hallmark of honesty and integrity. It's staggering to believe that they. I mean, Rick Perry, the governor of the biggest state on the mainland of the United States. I mean, just lying through his teeth about the Recovery Act, about stimulus. A governor's spokesman played down the money's role in shoring up Texas's finances. Quote, Texas would have balanced its budget regardless of the presence of stimulus dollars.
Yeah, they would have balanced it on the backs of poor people.
Yeah. Well, no. You know what? If that's the case,
$6 billion of fucking social, you know, services to cut.
Mm-hmm. If that's the case, quoting President Bartlett, let's have it back, please.
Right. Give it back.
Can you give it back?
You don't need it. We could take that $6 billion.
Yeah, I mean, $6 billion go a long way to setting up all that great high-speed rail that's going to bring huge economic prosperity to the East Coast, fuckers.
Yeah, it's it boggles the mind.
That sort of
disingenuousness is allowed.
Yeah, and it was that case with governors, Republican teabagger governors all across the United States. Mm-hmm. They ripped to shreds that stimulus money, but they had their hands wide open begging to have that money.
Oh, yeah, getting their pictures took with the great big checks.
Great big checks, yeah. And that's why, so Newt Gingrich says, you know, I want the country to look like Texas. But, you know, President Obama wants the country to look like Detroit. Well, you know what? Texas looks more like President Obama.
I mean, that's why he's fucking actively campaigning down there right now.
Then Newt Gingrich looks like Texas.
Oh my God, Newt Gingrich looks like Texas. He's so deluded, so deluded to think he could get a toehold in this process. He's so up his own ass.
Yeah, he just has no chance of running. I mean, this is all, again, this is the Republicans are running entirely based upon constructing their business models, their little media empires. Because yeah, I mean, this has everything to do with him being able to have that presidential candidate item on his in that lower third when he appears on Fox News.
Right.
Now, you could say Newt Gingrich, presidential candidate, instead of Newt Gingrich, author of a book in which he fantasized about the Confederates winning Gettysburg. Read it. I mean, he literally wrote a book about that. It's a book in which Robert E. Lee wins at Gettysburg.
Mm.
Which was ill-conceived.
Alternate history is awesome. Mm-hmm. When it's on the backs of black people. Yeah,
this is great. Isn't it great?
That's awesome.
I mean, it's so great to think about the idea of the Confederates winning the Civil War.
Yeah, those poor Confederates.
Which is just, it just ultimately would have balkanized, you know, the mainland of the United States. It would just have all been individual nations, each one, and not being able to have a common currency, not having, you know, sort of standard laws state to state. It has just been
a
nightmare.
We'd have to have trade pacts with, like, Mississippi. Like, you'd have to have an ambassador. Yeah. Oh, God, I got to send an ambassador to fucking Mississippi.
Each state with a new constitution every 2 years, right?
Right. Yeah, that would have been swell.
Yeah.
Who needed Lincoln, that douche? Kept you together.
Which actually reminds me, there was that story this week. Republicans in the House and the Senate are trying to pass introducing a constitutional amendment to give the state legislators, veto power over federal law.
Yeah, good luck with that. Good luck with that.
So basically, they're fashioning a fourth branch of government out of these ridiculous state legislatures. I mean, there are a lot of good people at the state level. The state houses and state legislatures, but there are a lot of real freak dogs at that level.
Fucktards.
And it's mostly fucktards. And so here are these guys at the federal level, handing over basically the reins of federal legislation to the states. A group of Republicans in the House and Senate are proposing an amendment to the Constitution that would allow a vote by 2/3 of the state legislatures to override any federal law they did not agree with.
Motherfuck that bill.
if there was any chance of it even passing, can you imagine the gridlock?
The gridlock
that would ensue. Nothing would get done. No laws would be passed. It would be a nightmare. And these are guys who are constitutional originalists. And so what they're doing, they love the original intent of the Constitution so much, you know, that three branches of government thing that the founding fathers came up with. They love it so much, they want to add a fourth branch.
Right.
Made up of the state legislatures.
Yeah. Well, they get hung up on the whole deal about, you know, everything that's not in this is up to the states and states' rights and fucking all that. And it's like, look, we tried that. It's Articles of Confederation basically didn't work for squat shit. We needed a powerful central government. That's what we've got now. So fuck you. We're not, you know, doing everybody raise their hand if they agree with this. I mean, can you imagine the civil rights era in the 60s? Okay, let's go poll Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, the Carolinas. Let's see what they think about that. Yeah. Fuck that.
So here's how this law would work. If 2/3 of the states collectively find a federal law regulation abhorrent or misguided, they should have the power to repeal said law or regulation. The law would then be sent back to Washington for further consideration, at which time Congress may choose not to act again on the matter, or they may vote to override the state's repeal and pass it in finality.
What the fuck?
I mean,
so it's like no, you didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. Yes, you did. It's just back and forth. I told you so. No, you didn't. Yeah. No, you fuck that. What the hell?
Yeah. I mean, just so ridiculous.
Oh,
I mean,
my
and
God.
This is coming from Senator Mike Enzi. This is coming from John Barrasso, Orrin Hatch. These aren't Orrin just Hatch, your run-of-the-mill wingnuts. These are like there are wingnuts on the House side. Rob Bishop, Morgan Griffith, and Paul Brown. Paul Brown's one of the nuttiest wingnuts.
Yeah. Orrin Hatch has been in that office since I was like 15. That guy's got to go.
Yeah.
He has got to go. The only reason I knew who Orrin Hatch was when I was a kid is that I stole a Playboy from my dad's closet. And there was he somehow in 1986 got his picture taken with some big titty girl, some like, I don't know, Italian porn star or something. It was a big thing. This is the first time I ever became aware of Orrin Hatch because I used to knock one out to the girl that he was had his arms around. I don't even remember what that scandal was, but it was 30 years ago. He needs to go. I hate that guy.
See, I thought maybe you were knocking it out.
It's a Playboy story. What the fuck?
You're going to knock it out to Orrin Hatch naked in there. In the Playboy.
Oh, that's a fail.
Did I step on that? I think I stepped on that. But, so that's that constitutional amendment. It never has any chance of passing. It's a symbolic bit of nonsense, just like that ridiculous Eric Cantor law that nullifies the entire lawmaking process as outlined in the Constitution. It's just symbolism for the ignoramuses in the Tea Party.
That's all it is. It's red meat for the states' rightsists and the Tea Party nut jobs that think that...
Yeah.
That lawmaking is a crime. Mm-hmm. Fuckers in Congress is all it's all unconstitutional.
I mean, can you imagine? I mean, it's basically like adding either a fourth branch to the federal government or it's adding another house to the Congress.
Yeah, that's more like, it's just a nuttier, stupider, more fucktardier House of Congress.
That's right. Yeah, as if the House of Representatives wasn't screwy enough.
Right.
What we need
is the August Senate is full of fucktards now. That's the last thing we need.
What we need are the state gomers to weigh in on federal law.
They are gomers.
They are gomers. It's like the, there's this other story out of West Virginia. One, a former state lawmaker, these talk about gomers. Referred to President Obama as a Sambo.
Oh!
This guy, Larry Faircloth, is GOP.
Oh, yeah. All of that guy.
Republican gubernatorial candidate, Larry Faircloth.
Sambo.
Called Barack Obama.
Oh, my
Sambo.
God.
Yep. Called Nancy Pelosi a bimbo. Yeah. These are the guys we want having veto power over federal legislation. When the states, you know what, and I'm going to quote Dennis Miller here from back when he was funny. When the states are able to pave roads, maybe we'll let them do something serious. Right. You know, exactly. But they right now they cannot pave roads. No. When they can fill in a pothole, maybe. Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Drive safely. You fudge with us. You fudge with the best. We'll be back next week, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.